Welcome to Real Crime Profile. I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for the long-running show Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And with me today is...
Allison Hope Weiner. I am the host of Crime Time. I'm also an attorney and a former journalist for the New York Times, and I also have an interest in crime, real-life crime, and in Criminal Minds.
And also with me today via the phone is...
Raquel Cohen. I'm a staff attorney with the California Innocence Project.
Well, thank you both ladies for being here. I'm honored and I'm thrilled. And as many of our listeners know, my usual co-hosts are Jim Clementi and Laura Richards. And they've been away for, I would say, like a month now working on a case. And literally around the clock, I get emails from them like at 1 a.m, texts from at 3 a.m. And this case has taken them around the country in search of the evidence that they're looking for. So they've promised me, though, that they will be back in town next week, and I can't wait to see them. And we're going to start a new series of episodes on a new case, and we will announce that shortly. But as you know, while they've been gone, I've been keeping the ship running, and I've been so blessed to have amazing guests, and today is no exception. So here to help me is my wing woman, Allison, and she is part of the Real Crime Profile family in a way. Allison, is that right?
Yes. Jim and I have done a lot of shows on Crime Time together, and I've done some shows with Laura Richards as well. I absolutely adore Jim Clementi. And his brother, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Tim on last podcast. Tim was on.
They're both amazing. And Laura is great. And so I'm thrilled to be here. I think it's a great podcast. And I have listened to it. So you guys are doing a wonderful job.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled she took time from her busy schedule to join us is Raquel Cohen. As she said, she's from the California Innocence Project. And one of the main reasons I wanted to hear from her is, as our listeners know, Jim is a former New York City prosecutor, right? And Laura is a fierce advocate for victims of domestic violence. And so it just so happens that the cases that we've covered, we've had a very pro-prosecutorial bend to them. And our podcast has been very, very critical of what Jim and Laura see as defense team dirty tricks, dirty strategies. So it was important to me, and I know important to our listeners, to have some balance and to hear from a different point of view, especially from a group who does such important work as the California Innocence Project. So Raquel has shared with me three very different cases today that she's been involved with. And if you go to their website, which is CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org, and that's California Innocence Project, one word, you'll be able to see the faces of the people we're going to be talking about. But we're going to cover three cases. One of Luis Vargas, Joanne Parks, and Patrick McNeil. So why don't we start, Raquel? I think I wanted to ask you, first of all, how do you choose your cases? And, you know, what can you tell us about the Innocence Project?
Well, the California Innocence Project, we're right out of California Western School of Law in San Diego. We have three main focus. One is obviously to get innocent people out of prison. If there was a wrongful conviction, then we do what we can to overturn that conviction in the courts. We also train law students to become really great attorneys and to take the values and the lessons that they learn here and apply them in whatever area they go into, whether it be defense work or being a prosecutor or even civil law. The task we teach them, I think, help them become a better lawyer. And our third is just to kind of focus on changing the problems in the criminal justice system to make sure that we have less wrongful convictions. Wrongful convictions are just the nature of having humans run anything, and the criminal justice system is run by humans, and so there are mistakes, and we need to see when there's a wrongful conviction, kind of look at it and see how can we prevent this from happening in the future. When we get a case, it has been vetted. It's been vetted very closely. We've done a lot of research on the case before we actually take it to court. So we get about 1,500 requests for assistance a year. We're one of the larger innocence projects in the world. And what we do with those cases is we rely a lot on volunteers and interns who come in and kind of read the initial letter and the initial request for help. And usually from that, we can tell if it's going to go on to the next step or not. For instance, because our resources are limited, we don't help people who have sentencing issues or have a legal defense question. So if they say, it was self-defense, but that was already brought up at trial, usually we can't take a case like that. But if we see from the initial questionnaire or the initial letter that they are actually claiming factual innocence, that means they were not there, they did not do this crime, they had nothing to do with it, then we we ask for more legal documents. We then have another group of volunteers who writes a memo for us telling us what happened at trial, what's the new or potential new evidence or new claims, and if we should keep this case and move on. From there, one of the attorneys reviews that memo and the file and decides if it will go on to student reviews and student investigation, and that's where our clinical interns and our education component comes from it. And there, the students will investigate the case under the supervision of an attorney and investigate the case for that evidence that we think proves the client's claim of innocence. And then if we do get that evidence, which is in a very small portion of cases, I think we file maybe 10 cases a year out of the 1,500 who write us. We file in the courts and then, you know, go for the good fight and try to get our clients out.
Let me ask you, is it a question of proving that they are innocent, or is it a question of showing that the prosecution didn't prove their case and that there isn't enough evidence to convince them, to convict them?
Our goal is to get innocent people out of prison. So the prosecution not proving their case, that may fall into a legal theory that we present the case, but
yes.
If we don't believe they're innocent, we don't believe the evidence shows that they are innocent, we won't take that case on. It just so happens there's only very few legal avenues that we can pursue, and a lot of that might be, well, this new or false evidence undermines the prosecution's case, but that's also because in our mind they're innocent.
So
we wouldn't say something that says, yeah, he may have done it, but you don't have the evidence. We wouldn't take a case like that.
Okay.
And in your experience, this is such a broad question, but are these people imprisoned because of deliberate misconduct by law enforcement, or just human mistakes, like you mentioned, that everybody makes mistakes and maybe they're reading evidence differently? What would you say about that?
I think a vast majority of the cases are innocent mistakes. That's because, you know, data backs that up. The number one cause of wrongful convictions is mistaken identification. And we know that through DNA. So these witnesses are not lying, and I don't believe that the police are always, trying to get somebody to pick the wrong person. I think sometimes inadvertently, because our identification process needs to be changed, needs to be fixed. I think sometimes it could be an inadvertent cue or clue, because we're always, as people trying to get the right answer, or a society who wants to help, wants to get the right answer. So I think it happens unintentionally a mass majority of the time. There are those small cases where I think maybe there was some problems on the government side or on one of the attorney side, but not. I don't think the end goal is to wrongfully convict somebody. What I think it is, and I think it will tie into the Patrick McNeil case and even the Joanne Parks case, and actually Louise Vargas, if you really think about it, is a tunnel vision where a party may believe they have the right suspect, and instead of having the evidence tell you the story, they maybe have the evidence fit the story they believe is true. So I don't think that if there is any bad intention, it's ever because they want, oh, I don't like this person, so I want them to go to prison for life. It's just a kind of a subjective bias.
Well, don't you think that there is a
confirmation bias?
Don't you think that there is a pressure on many of these prosecutors to have a certain record? We constantly hear them boast about winning all of their cases, and career-wise, that there is pressure on them to convict successfully once they take a case to trial. Do you think that that plays any role? And my second question also is, what role does poor defense play in these cases, poor defense representation?
I don't know if I can definitely say that prosecutors are just trying to get the win, and so they'll do anything at any expense. I don't believe that's true. I think that the evidence is presented to them, and then they believe their case, and they, again, the tunnel vision would be my thing, is that, you know, you have this person, you believe it's them, and so now your case is going to fit that, and then if you do later find out you made a mistake, maybe it's hard to admit that mistake, just because it's a huge mistake. It's something that you unintentionally made and somebody's life suffered 20 years or so. And so it's easier to say you didn't make it. I don't know. I don't know enough about, I haven't been in a prosecution's office to say that their goal is just get that conviction. So I can't completely answer that question. I would like to believe that's not the case and that these are just very unintentional mistakes in our criminal justice system. For the defense side, we definitely have cases, and many of our cases are based on ineffective assistance of counsel. When you're dealing with a public agency, like a public defender's office, I think a major cause of having ineffective assistance of counsel is being overworked. And that's just the nature of funding. And you can't really turn a case down when you're a public defender because it's based on a different criteria. And then when you have the private defense counsel, which is more likely to be an ineffective successful ineffective assistance of counsel claim, it comes from inexperience and just taking on a case that maybe you were in over your head.
Who foots the bill for your clients? I mean, is this pro bono work, or are they billed just like any other?
Our clients don't pay us anything. Mm-hmm. We work for them pro bono. Like I said, we are ran out of California Western School of Law, and so we have an office in there, and they cover our overhead, and our salaries are paid by grants and donations. But our clients themselves, their families, we do not accept money from them.
So, Raquel, why don't we turn to the first case we're going to talk about, which is Luis Vargas. You want to explain why he was in prison and how you got him exonerated?
Sure. Luis Vargas got convicted of sexually assaulting three different victims in the Los Angeles area in the late 90s. His crimes were connected. He was convicted based on eyewitness identification solely. Three victims came in and eventually identified him throughout the process. Their identifications, they became more certain as the process went on. And so when they got in court, they all positively identified him as a perpetrator. The crimes he was convicted of were all very similar. They were in the early morning hours near a bus stop. The perpetrator would ask the victim, usually a Hispanic victim, for directions for the bus, and then once they engage in a conversation, would pull out a knife, relocate them to an alley or somewhere secluded, and attempt to sexually assault them. In the three, he only penetrated one. The other two were able to escape before being penetrated. One was groped, and one actually scared him away before it went too far. Because they were so similar, the crimes, and because they all positively identified him, that's how he went down for all three. At the same time, very similar time, this was happening throughout Los Angeles. I think there was one or two, the same crime happened before he was convicted, and after he was convicted and went in prison, I think the same exact crime, early morning hours near a bus stop with a knife, relocation, easily scared off, man kept committing these crimes, and eventually this perpetrator got dubbed as the teardrop rapist, and he is yet to be found. He's responsible, according to the FBI website, for about 35, I think it's now 39, crimes of that were done exactly the same, and I think about 11 of them, according to the FBI website, were connected through DNA. So when we got the case, our first initial thought was that we were going to have a problem getting an exoneration because we only had DNA from one of the victims, the one that was penetrated. But when we learned about the teardrop rapist and that his crimes were identical to our client, we thought, okay, well, if this DNA by chance were to match the DNA by the teardrop rapist, and we were able to show they were the exact same crime, then I think it would prove his innocence on all three. And in fact, that's exactly how it went down, which we were very shocked to see. We got the DNA from the clothing of the victim who they actually saved the clothing from that victim. And once we got the results, we matched it to the teardrop rapist. And then the district attorney agreed with us that he was wrongfully convicted and should not be re-prosecuted. And so that's how he got exonerated.
So to clarify, there was already a rapist on the loose that they had called the teardrop rapist. And why was that? Why was he called that?
Most of the victims would identify one or two teardrops on the perpetrator's face, underneath his eye. And my client had a very light teardrop tattoo under his eye that he got when he was really young. He was living in a bad neighborhood, and he was trying to fit in with the gangs. And so I think a neighbor gave him a little teardrop under his eye, and it was very faded, very hard to see. But because he had that, he matched the description of two of his victims. But if you read about the teardrop rapist, not every victim says there's a teardrop. Not every victim says there's one or two. It's very varying on if he had a teardrop or not.
So they already had this guy's DNA. They had this teardrop rapists?
Not at the time. I don't believe they had it at the time of when he was in trial and during his conviction. That came later because that was when DNA became more popular and more widely used. They did look for DNA on the victim in Luis's case early on, but at the time of testing, you needed more DNA. You needed, and it wasn't as sensitive. But
more of a
today,
sample.
The DNA testing is much more sensitive, and you can get better results from very small amounts of DNA.
It's my understanding that it's incredibly difficult when somebody has been convicted, and we've talked about this on Crime Time, to get them out of prison because the system is made to, once somebody is convicted, not to keep retrying the same thing. It's just sort of made to be very final. And I'm just curious that how many years did it take you and how many motions or how long did it take you to convince the district attorney that this gentleman was, in fact, innocent?
You'd be correct. It is very hard to get a conviction overturned. I think we have Supreme Court cases say they want to uphold the integrity of the conviction. I began working on this case in 2011, and it took many years to even find out if any of the evidence existed. Once I got confirmation that the evidence was there, it took years again to even get the district attorney did agree that we should do testing, so luckily, we didn't have to fight that in court. Once I filed the motion and we had a few conversations, they said, okay, let's do this testing. And we did. And then once we got the results, however, I think it took over a year to get them to concede that he was wrongfully convicted. And their big holdup was that we only had DNA on one. But then at the end of the day, they said the crimes were just so identical to the teardrop rapist and that in all three of his crimes that it would just, you know, undermine their case and pointed unerringly to innocence is actually the legal standard we met in his case.
So you talked about eyewitness testimony in this case, and I know that Jim has said that eyewitness testimony is the least reliable kind of testimony. So I think if Jim were here, you know, this would all resonate with him.
As well as ear witness testimony. We've also talked about that in different trials. How sophisticated, I mean, do you think some of these cases are rather old, but are you dealing with more recent cases where there was sophisticated sort of forensic evidence and that evidence has been wrong? I mean, how sophisticated are the juries now that you're going in front of? Do they put a lot of value on eyewitness testimony, or do they look for something more concrete?
I think you're going to see a lot less juries relying 100% on eyewitness identification if you have DNA proving otherwise. I don't think it's going to get to a jury at that point. I think that's what DNA is going to be. That's the difference with the DNA today. I think had they been able to do the DNA testing and get the results they got on Vargas today, if they had done that in the beginning, he may not have even ended up as charged and in front of a jury. So I think that's where you're going to see your difference. I think we're going to have a lot less, DNA is going to play a lot less in post-conviction relief, and it's going to be more in the pre-trial stages and preventing these wrongful convictions, and that's how I think it's going to play in, and so it's going to limit the number of bad eyewitness identifications because you're not even going to get to that point.
So he was sentenced in 1999. Are you saying that there's been a rapist on the loose for, if I do my math correctly, over 16 years? I mean, this is an unsolved case. Really.
Yeah. I think the teardrop rapist, now that they've gone back, started in 1994 or 96. I'm sorry. I wish I remember. It's either 1994 or 1996. And his last attack was in 2012.
That's incredible.
Well, not been caught.
Yeah. Less reported attack.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so what's that like, Raquel, when you, that must be so, like, what a wonderful feeling when you get the word that he's exonerated. I mean, how does that all happen? I mean, just how do you tell him?
Or how does she tell him?
Yeah. How does that all go down?
It's amazing because, I mean, you know, you work on the, you don't think that day is coming. It's just kind of, you go through the steps. Okay, I'm going to file this motion. Okay, I'm going to do this. And, you know, you do have the end result in your mind, but you're just taking the steps necessary to get the evidence to see if you are wasting your time or if this is a valid claim. I remember when the analyst had informed us that did match was to the Teardrop Rapist, and thinking we were just overwhelmed with excitement and just shocked, because when does it ever work out that way where you get DNA evidence and then it matches this unknown profile? That was amazing. Telling him, you know, we went down to the prison to tell him, and I joke with him all the time, because when I did tell him, he was kind of, there was not a lot of emotion, mm-hmm. and I always tell him, like, you know, that was really anticlimactic for me, because I expected more. But really, he was just in shock, and he was saying, like, I didn't know, like, I just didn't know how to react. I knew what you were saying, but it's just for years I've been screaming, you know, at the top of my lungs, I'm innocent, nobody believed me, and then just to have that happen in seconds was surreal to him.
And he must not want to get his hopes up, too. He doesn't want it, you know, to get his hopes up and then have it be dashed by some other technicality,
We definitely keep our clients' expectations in the middle. I don't want them to get too high or too low. I want them to have hope, but I don't want them to put all their eggs in that basket. And with him, it was like, okay, we got DNA on one. Now we got to convince everybody that all three of these crimes were committed by that same person, and that same person was not you.
Mm. And do you want to share what he's doing now?
He's doing amazing. He lives with his mom in Los Angeles. He is working to get a job. He wants to do social work and help people in similar situations as him, and people who are just struggling with drugs or alcohol, and just kind of getting back into society. He may be one of the most positive people I've ever met in my life. There's never not a smile on his face. He is caring and sweet and just so grateful to be alive. You can just see him enjoying every moment of his life. So he's doing really well.
And guys, my listeners, if you do go to the California Innocence Project website, you can see a picture of Luis, and he's got a smile on his face. He's in his cap and gown, surrounded by family. And thank you, Raquel, for making that happen for him. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some more cases. And we're back from our break with my wonderful guests, Allison Weiner and Raquel Cohen. Can I just say how nice it is to have three ladies in this room? Because sometimes my last few episodes have been so full of testosterone. I mean, I've had like an oxygen mask in here. So it's really nice, sorry, to have you here, and such wonderful lady. So anyway, okay. So we're going to go on to our next case, which, oh my gosh, when I read about this story,
it's tragic.
It just hit me. Oh God. So we're going to talk about Joanne Parks, who was convicted of three counts of first degree murder. And Raquel, do you want to take it from there and describe what she was accused and convicted of?
Absolutely. Joanne Parks was convicted of murdering her three children via arson. So Joanne and her family, they were not very wealthy. They had just moved in a week before into a little converted garage. I think it was 520 square feet, and it was a three-bedroom house. I still can't really make out those dimensions in my head. But so it was a converted two-car garage that they made into a house, and they moved in a week before that. Her husband had worked late, put the kids to sleep, went to sleep herself, and then was woken up by her kids screaming. And when she went to check on them, she realized that the house was on fire. And she ran outside, went to her neighbor's house, and was asking for help. And unfortunately for her three children, the house was just so small that it burned up so quickly, they did not survive. And so she ended up getting convicted of intentionally starting the fire. Her conviction was based on, it took 3 years for them to charge her for the crime. It started out as they thought it was an electrical fire in her living room. And then when the electrical engineer, the specific wires they sent to her, said they didn't think that those wires caused the fire, the investigation then turned to her and saying that she intentionally started the fire. Her conviction is based on, we call it false science. And the best, it's hard to explain. My best way to explain it is that everybody goes through seventh grade science. You're part of a science fair. You know that you have a hypothesis, and then you have science to back up. You test that hypothesis, and it's either accurate or it's not. arson science and being able to read fire patterns at the time of Joanne's conviction was not subjected to any kind of testing. It completely relied on being trained on the job training and your superior telling you this is how you read a fire, this is what you do, this kind of pattern means that it was gasoline, this kind of pattern means this and that, and so on. Well, over the years, that has been tested, and it has been proven that there's problems. There's a lot of problems with arson science. The biggest problem is that it still, even with all the testing, remains one of the most subjective sciences. I'm putting it in air quotes just because science shouldn't, there's subjectivity in everything, but the amount of subjectivity that goes into arson makes it very questionable if we should be putting people away on something that could either be a flip of a coin, really, when it comes down to it. You can flip a coin and get the same outcome as you did with Joanne's case. So we have filed a petition saying that she got life without the possibility of parole. So if she doesn't get relief in the court, she is not getting out ever. She lost everything one night, woke up, lost everything, has been convicted of this on something we do not believe was an arson based on looking at the case now. There were electronics in the area that were not ever held to be tested, a faulty TV that they believe it's a Zenith TV, I think it was a 1979, that now has been proven to cause fires, wasn't tested because the investigator said it wasn't that, the TV didn't start it. He didn't say anything, he didn't collect it, he just says, I know the TV didn't start it based on my training, so because my training said so, I didn't think to, I'm not going to preserve that evidence. We don't even have that to go back on. What we do have, though, is that their main areas on what they base their determination that it was arson that have been disproven and shown that you can't, they're not reliable. And so we're challenging in the court based on false science and hoping that we, even at the best case scenario, she should get a new trial and the science that was relied on should not be introduced to the jury.
Raquel, other than the physical evidence, the arson evidence that they think happened, was there any other motivation that they said? I mean, was there something in her background, some sort of abuse? I mean, something that they think was her motivation to do this?
They didn't have a motivation, like they couldn't say, oh, she was so upset with her children, they were driving her crazy or anything. She did have a prior house fire in her house years before that that was an accidental fire caused by an electrical fire that could be chalked up to poor living. She wasn't very wealthy and she lived in areas that weren't well kept. And so they used that when, this is again, when I had mentioned before, I believe this was a tunnel vision case. They came in, they couldn't pinpoint that it was this wire. They found out through their investigation, they found out about her prior fire, and then the investigation just all of a sudden turned towards her and all the pieces started to fall together that, oh, it had to be arson and she had to intentionally start this fire. And
Was the prior fire admitted into evidence?
It was, yes.
Okay, so let me just ask you this. When if you do get a new trial, then do you argue that the arson evidence is unsound and not scientific in terms of arson investigation? I know that there's been a lot of arguments made by defense attorneys that the bite mark evidence is not scientific and should not be admitted, and people that are convicted on that evidence, a lot of that is being overturned and the experts have been found to be really lacking and the science to be lacking. So when you go back to trial, is there new arson evidence that is admitted or that is presented, or do you try to get rid of the arson evidence altogether because you find it so scientifically unpersuasive?
I mean, the hope would be
flawed,
that none of it can come in because it's not proven. It's not it shouldn't be relied upon. But the arson science isn't there. Like, if you take shaken baby syndrome as another one of those cases where it used to be this theory that you had these triad of symptoms, and if you have that, then it had to be shaken baby syndrome. And now they're showing that, in fact, things like a shortfall or a vitamin D deficiency could actually cause these triad of symptoms. And those cases are also being overturned on, this isn't a science that we should rely upon. Jury shouldn't be hearing that. Bite mark evidence is being has been found inadmissible because it just doesn't have the scientific value that they once thought it did. In a perfect world, I don't know that arson in every case should be introduced in trial. And specifically, I can get into the details. It may be a lot for the listeners, but there's this what's called post-flashover conditions. And so if you have like a chair in the middle of a room and it starts burning, it gets so hot that it's not actually the flames that are causing other areas to start on fire. It's the heat. And so the heat then makes the whole room burn. It's called full room involvement. And so anything that's post-flashover, the burn patterns become insignificant. And in Joanne Parks, it was a post-flashover condition. And so these burn patterns become less significant than they would if they would have put out the fire early. And you would say, oh, obviously the chair burned is the only thing that started. The fire started in the chair because it's the only thing burned in the room. But once the whole room is burned down, it's they've done tests where it's almost as close as a flip of a coin where an investigator can get the accurate reading of a fire. So I think that there's still two sides of this. People are going to hear this podcast and they're going to say, you know, this girl doesn't know what she's talking about. Fire science is amazing and it does actually prove something. And then there's going to be the other side who says, no, she's right. Science needs to be reevaluated. It's not at the point where the community's in agreement on which way we should go.
And it took a very long time to get the bite mark evidence declared to be inadmissible. Let me just ask you this. My understanding is from looking at the case that you online on your website is that there was a finding by the arson investigator that the fire had started in two places, and that's something that you have disproved at this point based upon the carbon monoxide content in the children's lungs. Could you explain a little bit about how you are going to argue that they got this wrong about the fire starting in two points, which makes a better case for having been arson?
You know, actually, we need to update our website just as recently. That has our argument on the carbon monoxide in the lungs has been disproven by it's this video of somebody burning and the carbon monoxide burning like in front of a camera, and then the carbon monoxide levels are still high. So that is actually just recently in an article that was sent to me been disproven. The bigger argument that there were not two fires started are that it's more consistent with a drop down fire, meaning that something else caught on fire and dropped down and made this pattern. It's called a V pattern, and investigators back then said if there's a V pattern, that's an area of origin. So then because there was a V pattern on this wall, it had to be an area of origin. But now we're starting to show, again, with post-flashover conditions, you can't make that call. You can't say because there's other reasons a V pattern may have been started. And so the carbon monoxide levels, although it was a great one, you know, the science was where it was, it was a great argument. We can't stand by that with the new testing that has been, that has come out.
Okay.
Raquel, do you know who Bob Ruff is? Have you heard of Bob Ruff?
The name sounds really familiar, but my memory might need to be refreshed.
Well, Bob Ruff has a very popular podcast called Truth and Justice, where he does amazing things for people he feels are falsely accused, and he does a lot of ground sourced investigating on his own. But before he did this, he actually was an arson inspector. And he's a really interesting guy, and I wonder if he would also be interested in Joanne Parks' case or somebody who could talk to you about this. I mean, he's been very, very – he's an advocate of Adnan Syed, and so he's been very involved in trying to get Adnan a new trial, and he's taken up a couple of other – who he feels are falsely imprisoned people. And he's a super fantastic guy. I've met him before anyway. So he might be somebody that you might want to reach out to. I don't know, to get his point of view on the case. Just throwing that out there to you. Just, you know, I'm sure that you have plenty of experts, but he's somebody who's just a good person to know. And I think he could be helpful. Perhaps.
That's great. I mean, the more people that can look at the case and give us their evaluations, the better. I mean, we're looking at something that is not as clean as arson. You have that. I mean, as clean as DNA. You have DNA in Luis Vargas's case. And then with Joanne Parks, what you have is, you know, two people saying two different things, and just you have to, you know, we're just trying to get to where bright mark evidence is to say, you know, we shouldn't be relying on this very subjective, untested science.
Allison, have you ever been in a fire? Have you ever been in a house fire? I'm just curious. Have you ever experienced that?
No. Have you?
Well, what I did experience is my little sister was taking a nap one day, and I just like ducked my head in to check on her, and she was really little, and she had put her pillow like over the bedside table light because I guess it was bothering her, and it had started to burn, and I can just see how quickly that room would have just gone up in flames before any of us would have known about it, you know, and my heart, oh God, you know.
That's terrifying.
Thank goodness that I, you know, went in and checked on her. And just thinking about those children, is the husband still in the picture? Is he supporting his Joanne, or is he sort of?
I don't believe they speak anymore. I know at trial he did not believe that she committed an arson, and he testified on her behalf. She's been in for over 20-something years. I don't believe that they have contact anymore, so I can't speak on where his mind is or how he feels about the case at this point. I just know at trial he did not believe she started the fire.
Well, my heart goes out to them as a parent myself. That is just a horrifying story, and I hope that you can get her exonerated.
Yeah, and just for your listeners to know, one of the most famous cases of arson is the case of Cameron Willingham. He was wrongfully convicted and executed in Texas. In fact, his conviction didn't get overturned on false fire arson science until after he was executed.
And oh, my God.
Interesting case to read on and kind of get an idea of what I'm talking about if I wasn't able to articulate it well enough to say what is wrong with this arson science and why we should not be executing and or putting people in prison for life on this faulty science.
Yeah. Any other questions for her, Allison,
no,
in this case?
No, I think not.
Okay, so we are going to turn to the last case that we're going to discuss with you, and that is another person who is still imprisoned, and that's Patrick McNeil. And he was a San Bernardino County probation officer. So, Raquel, you want to talk about his story?
Absolutely. Patrick he was married and his wife was 6 months pregnant. He was at work at the time, as you said, as a probation officer, and his wife had to go to a doctor's appointment, and they had been talking on the phone throughout the day. She was upset, just having a bad day, and he came home to take her to her doctor's appointment, and when he got home, he found her deceased. She was brutally strangled and then brought and submerged in water in a bathtub. And when he got there, he panicked. He tried to take her out of the bathtub. He couldn't get her out. So he looked for the phone. He couldn't find the phone. His house had been ransacked. Pillows had been ripped up. TVs were broken. Things were everywhere. So he ran to the neighbor's house. They called 911. And when they got there, eventually the investigation was aimed at Patrick. It's a really big problem. And again, this goes to my tunnel vision, where he was the last person with the body. They believed he had motive to do it, and so they focused their investigation on him, and eventually he was convicted of this crime. Our theory, one, he didn't have the time to do it. He left work at 12:15. We have eyewitnesses and evidence, that being the last time he worked on his computer at work. His coworkers riding down on an elevator with him, that he left work at 12:15. I think the phone call was made at 12:30 or 12:32 from his house, and just the timeline makes it nearly impossible for him to have come home to take his wife to a doctor's appointment, somehow get enraged, and then be able to, I think they said the strangulation would take anywhere between 1 to 3 minutes. Drag her, get her in water, then get the police there, and do that all, mind you, with no blood on him. That, either way, those facts were still available for the jury. The jury didn't buy it, and he ended up getting convicted of the crime. Years later, we had heard from various witnesses, including a mutual sister between who we believe is the perpetrator, Jeffrey West, and Patrick McNeil, his sister, and a few other people, where Jeffrey West had admitted he was the one who killed Deborah, and he was bragging about it, and we presented that to the San Bernardino courts, and they did not find our witnesses credible, and so he remains in prison.
So this Jeffrey West that you're talking about, that's his half-brother?
That's correct, they are related by mother.
And it says on the website that Jeff had committed other murders. So was he subsequently...
Was he
convicted subsequently?
He went to prison in Las Vegas for murdering two drug dealers. And I'm a little bit vague because it's been years since I have looked at his conviction, but it was very similar in that they were submerged in water. I think he rolled them up in a rug or something and put them in water. He had other history of doing bad things, like putting his friend's dog in a cooler and drowning it. And just, he's a very violent person, and he has a conviction for murder in Las Vegas, but he has since served his time in Las Vegas and is now, I believe, living as a free man. I'm not sure, though.
He served his time for double murder, and he's out? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Let me ask you about Patrick McNeil and what about his... What really factored in? What was the evidence that really seemed to sway the jury in terms of convicting him? Did it have something to do with the relationship that he had with his pregnant wife prior to her murder?
Yeah, and I think you see it's common. I think that the cops had been called for some domestic disputes between the two. I think he had called the cops. I think she had called the cops. It was never physical. They just kind of argued and it would go over the top, and then the cops would be called. And so I think that was held against him in front of the jury, and that was a big part of it.
And it's true that the husband usually becomes the prime suspect in a murder like this, so it's not really that surprising that they would focus on him.
Was there a DNA testing at the murder scene besides her being in the tub if she had been beaten up in the house? Did he have any wounds to his hands or any kind of physical wounds on him?
No, there weren't any of that. There was really no physical evidence tying him to the crime, except for he found the body and he was there. Again, this was a very bloody crime scene. I believe a forensic blood pattern specialist looked at the case and said that the perpetrator would have blood on them. So if he did it, he would also have to have cleaned himself off. This is common in our cases when we have a case where we just got an exoneration. Kimberly Long came home, found her boyfriend dead, and she was convicted, 7 years wrongfully convicted of that murder. We have Bill Richards, who came home, and they lived in a secluded area in San Bernardino, tripped over his wife's body. He was convicted. He was found with the body. There was no other suspect. Again, I believe it's just tunnel vision. They were there. They had, and he was convicted just recently this year, exonerated of that crime as well.
Yeah, in Patrick's case, did they ever establish a time of death for Deborah?
That wasn't done at the time. The time of death analysis was not done at that time.
Because I would imagine that one of the arguments the prosecution made is that he killed her before he went to work. And, you know, so that would explain the timeline.
Yeah, but that wouldn't work because she had guests over. We had people testified who had seen her early in the morning, and they had phone conversations. She had had a conversation with the hospital to make her appointment for her doctor's appointment.
Mm, okay.
And so time of death in Patrick's case is interesting because, those are all based on witness testimony that they had seen her and spoken to her that day. But time of death isn't something that pinpoints, like, to the exact minute. It's usually a range. It will say based on the body decomposition, it would be between 12 and 3 or something like that. And so with him, when you have all those witnesses testifying that they've seen her up until this time, at the time, if you find those witnesses credible, you really wouldn't be able to get a time of death expert that would say, actually it was 12:31 and he was driving at that point.
Right.
Now, how far have you gotten in attempting to get this one overturned?
How far have we got? To get his case overturned?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Where are you in the process?
Well, right now we're asking the governor to grant clemency. So he and also Joanne Parks and the two other cases I talked about, Kimberly Long and Bill Richards, are part of a group called the California 12. And what we did, our office did, Alyssa Biracle from my office, Justin Brooks and Mike Samanchuk, they walked from San Diego to Sacramento to deliver 12 clemency petitions to the governor on cases we identified where we've hit roadblocks and really clemency seemed to be the only option. They did that in 2013. Since then, four people have gotten out of prison through other means. And now we're still fighting, though, to get the other eight. So our main focus with Patrick right now is asking the governor, hey, look at this case. It's really nearly impossible for him to do this. We have this third-party confession. Somebody else is another potential perpetrator, and he should not be serving time for this crime. And the jury just didn't get it right.
Another question about this, Allison? So, Raquel, how do you – I don't know how to ask this. Like, how do you not get cynical and want to just run screaming from the building and not ever look at these cases again? It must be so incredibly frustrating because it's such a long game. You know, you have to play the long game in these things. And I don't know how you sustain yourself. How do you sustain your optimism? How do you sustain your clients? It just must be so hard on you.
It is hard. It has its downs and it has, but it's ups. You know, we had two exonerations. We brought three people out of prison within a month of each other this year, and so that keeps us going. It's always nice to have. You know, we got a message from Bill Richards. You know, he just got out. He's living with an old attorney from our office, and she sent us, you know, I saw Bill on his bike today. He was riding down the street, and he had this huge smile on his face, and you could just tell he was like enjoying his life. You know, that's what keeps me going. That it's hard, the fight is long, but it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, and we just got to stick with it because if we're not doing it for them, who is? If we walk away and we say, you know, this is too hard, it's too frustrating, then there is no hope for them on the other end. And you do it because you know that there is that potential that you will give someone their life and help them rebuild their life. It's the hope. You got to have that little bit of hope. And don't get me wrong. Don't think that there are times we lose cases and it's hard for me to get out of bed in the morning because I've, you know, built a relationship with this client and now I feel I failed them. The system has failed them. And what's the next step? But there's always a next step and we don't give up when we believe in our clients.
Yeah, you sound incredibly optimistic. It's really amazing, you know. So if somebody wants to help, what should they do? If they want to, I mean, they can donate. I know they can go to the website, but what are the things that you need the most?
Donations are always great, and that can be on the website because we do need costs to litigate these cases, to investigate these cases. We're not getting paid, so that is very, very helpful. We do take we run basically on volunteers and interns, and so on our website there's an area where you can reach out and ask for an internship. Recently, we have really revamped our internship and volunteer program, so it's become very competitive to get an internship here or a volunteer position. But that doesn't mean that, you know, if you're interested, you should reach out and try, because we've had people come in. One of our board members started as a volunteer here. She was just interested in it. She had no legal background, but we were like, hey, let's try her out. And she is now, like, basically a free staff member. She loves this work. She said she found her passion. And her name is Jasmine. She is one on our fundraising board and has integrated herself into our little family and is amazing help. She's a help to our exonerees. That's something that that's an area we really lack in is being able to help our exonerees when they get out of prison.
So when you get out on,
like, let's say parole, the state gives you money, they give you lodging, they help you reintegrate. When you get exonerated, the door opens for you and they say good luck. So we end up forking the bill to get them, like the attorneys will just pool money together to buy them clothes, to buy them a toothbrush, to buy them soap, to get them shoes, things like that. So helping our clients get reintegrated is an area where we could use funding and support in that area. So if you're somebody who maybe a social worker background or something like that, who can point us in the right direction, that's help we can use too.
Well, Allison, what are you up to these days? I want to include you in this conversation, too.
I am just working on finding a new home for Crime Time after we're no longer with the Lip TV, the Lip.TV. So we're looking to find a new place and to bring back sort of the same kind of discussion that you're having here. Even though Jim Clemente's been on my show many times, as is Laura Richards, we actually try to look at things from the same perspective as Raquel, sort of innocent, even sometimes after being proven guilty in a shoddy fashion. I don't share her I mean, I'm not doing the same kind of work, but I don't share her optimism sometimes because I've talked to and seen too many cases where prosecutors really let their ego override. I mean, there is a sense, as she said, a type of tunnel vision, but oftentimes I think I've seen it be ambition and refusal to see many of these defendants as human beings. And all kinds of other bias that is at play, and a certain cynicism that many prosecutors bring to the job. So I like to look at cases and to give people the benefit of the doubt and to really not judge even until they're convicted, and then even after they're convicted, if it's been a really unfair trial, to talk about that too on Crime Time. So that's kind of what I'm up to.
Well, Raquel, do you have anything else you want to say before we sign off?
No, it was great to hear, though, what Allison's doing. It's awesome that there are other people, fighting the good fight and giving these people a chance to be heard again. So I just love hearing that there's more people out there.
I'm impressed with what you're up to. I'm really impressed with what you're doing. I think it's really important, and I know the kind of cynicism that people have about after somebody's been convicted. It is such an uphill fight, besides the institutional aspects that we've been discussing here today and how the courts view a conviction and their hesitancy and reluctance to overturn them. There is also kind of the feeling that even sometimes before when somebody's just indicted that they're already guilty. So it's a very difficult job that you're doing, and I take my hat off to you.
Thank you.
Well, ladies, thank you very much for being here for me. I really appreciate it. I can't believe how you just dropped everything and Allison ran over here. And I would have loved to have brought Raquel up to LA, but I know she's got much more important things to be doing. So thank you, my dear, for being here. And I know my listeners have missed Jim and Laura, and boy, I sure have too. I can't wait for them to get back, and I'm going to hug them tightly and hand the microphone to them because it's really hard to do this without them. And I know my listeners miss them too, but hopefully I've been able to keep the car running and while Mom and Dad have been away. So I guess that's it for us.
Well, thanks.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon.
So if you like our show and you want to help us out, there are a couple things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and leave us a positive 5-star review. You can also like our Facebook page and join in on some great questions, comments, and conversations. We always love to hear from you there. You can follow us on Twitter. You can check out our sponsors. And most importantly, you can share us with friends, family, and anyone you know who's interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. Thanks for listening.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org, or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.